Tim doesn't need any introduction to the W3C community or the web community at large. We've discussed a number of things today, all of which, you know, a lot of it was couched in religion and, you know, beliefs of one way of doing things versus the other. But at the end of the day, all of us do the things, the way we do things differently. We still do it on the same World Wide Web. And Tim's talk about cracks in the web architecture and what might be relevant for the community to fix over time, I think is extremely relevant given the context of where we are on the web today. So without too much saying too much further, I would hand it over to Tim by saying, here's the man who's been to the Royal Palace to be recognized not once, but twice, while continuing to insist on the royalty-free web. I give you Sir Tim.
I must say, when I, given that this meeting includes more or less everything that is W3C, it was difficult for me to figure out what to talk about. I spent a lot of time wondering about it and rejected a whole lot of things. And I'm not sure, I'm not very happy with this, partly because talking about cracks and mortar is about, it sounds a bit like talking about sort of the problems with the web. And in fact, I'm spend most of my time being excited about all the opportunities we have coming forward. And in fact, I found working on the talk was, I kept getting distracted by working on the sort of the opportunity side of things. But what I intended to do was to take a bit of a tour of the web architecture, just looking for things. And it occurred to me that the analogy of these cracks is that when you see in the building, you see a slot between two bricks. There's two possibilities. One is that the building is starting to dry up, for example, and the building is losing its structural integrity, and soon it's going to fall down. Or there's some substance or something. Another possibility is that it's been carefully put there and filled with rubber, and it's been so that the two parts of the building can change temperature, change their size slightly, and the building won't fall down. So that when you get these gaps, sometimes gaps are cracks, and sometimes, in fact, they are expansion. They're there for expansion. They're important. And the web has got all these various slots in it, and I think we have heard various opinions today about which of them are cracks and which of them are expansion gaps. First of all, I want to say I really enjoy this meeting just because there is so much good stuff going on, and it is great to be in these corridors constantly bumping into people who want to talk to you, stop you getting your talk done, and things like that, and about all kinds of different things. Keep up the good work, everybody. It's, you know, the spirit of creativity in this space is wonderful, and I just can, in this week, if I didn't have to give talks and things, I could just sit there and lap it up. As I said a little bit before, one of the spirit of W3C is very much to remember that when you're in a group, remember that there are other groups. And one of the nice things about the technical plenary is if you've actually managed to get here, then you can go and see them. And if you can't see the groups, then you can find the people and you can talk to them in the bar and you can buy them breakfast and whatever it takes to figure out how they tick and why on earth they had made such a stupid decision in paragraph 6 of section 2. So, you know, use that. Go and talk to them. Other groups, larger groups, remember that, you know, we tend to be sort of white male geek culture, if we're not careful, thinking in English, working under the assumption that our application is a browser, and there are people with other applications, cultures, languages, and things. So we're part of a much larger group, which doesn't necessarily speak for itself here. We're also peer of other organizations, so we can't just sit down and rewrite HTTP without first talking to the HTTPS working group, which is starting in the IETF, for example. And there are smaller groups. We have to also be careful within our groups that there may be a little group of people who actually do something different from the larger group, and we mustn't stomp on them because that's not very nice, but also they may represent a much bigger group than the rest. You know, they may actually, the two people we have in the group who've got that particular, well, one particular idea may actually be representing a pretty big constituency out there. So the world is a mess of interconnected communities. That's why it works. I've given talks before to calling it a fractal tangle. Our job is to design our process to work in this fractal tangle, and also to design our technology to support the fractal tangle of different communities. All right, now I'm going to talk about, I said earlier that one of the most important things for me is that the World Wide Web has got this follow your nose principle. In fact, I've spent some time, I won't show you this diagram. I'm designing a diagram which shows more or less, if you start off with a URI at the top and you strip the hash off it, you go through a number of decision marks, but there is a flowchart that you can go through to figure out how it should be displayed and what it really means. And the whole reason that you can use the URI to stand for a document is that because everybody shares this flowchart, and because it starts with just the URI. Although in the tag, we did notice that XC sometimes assumes that for some forms of compression using the XC way of sending XML, if it's the way of sending XML, that there is some, in fact, a little bit of information has been exchanged between the parties in advance in order to get the compression up. A little bit of schema information, for example. So there's this whole flowchart that you go down through, and I'm going to mention a few of the points where there is this sort of, expansion gap. First one is the content type, okay? MIME types, internet media types, internet content types, whatever what you call them. This is one of the most fundamentally useful expansion points in the web, and it allows, for example, a server to evolve independently of the thing that links to something. So I can write a web page, and in it I can refer to an image, and later on somebody can replace the image with something which has got higher resolution options, something which is more sensitive to what sort of device I've got, may have image which has got accessibility options in more languages or something, or it may be that a new image format comes along. So it's very useful if I can refer to that image in a way which is independent of the way the server this year has found to serve it. Remember, a lot of these links last for a long time. Video may be cool, but these videos, we really want the pages we present with videos to be viewable by our grandchildren so they can understand what we were doing and why we were thinking in these strange ways. So this independence is one of these rubber pieces. It allows me to change my server even though you've linked to my image, for example. So that's why I think it's a problem when the HTML5 spec proposes that if an image you should look at the MIME type in the referring document. And even if the server serves it up a JPEG, if the document says no, but actually you should parse it as a ping or you should parse it as a GIF, then ignore the server. The architecture is, excuse me, that the server is authoritative about what it's serving. It has the right to go and make with content negotiation, serve better images later. That's really important. We don't change image formats very slowly, but very fast, but we do change. And this sort of thing allows us to change. It allows, and in video, clearly, we're going to be changing. We're only just starting down that path. We don't know how the politics is going to go. We don't know how the technology is going to go around the container formats and especially around the compression formats. So it's really important that we leave this coupling joint, that we can refer to a video, which may be in Ogthiora now, or maybe it'll be in a choice of formats in the future. All right, so, by the way, content negotiation is pretty useful. You can do it in Apache out the box. If you set it up the right way, and in fact, so you can set up as on W3C site, you'll find, for example, our icon doesn't have a .ping on the end of it, or a .gif, because in fact both exist, but we just refer to it without that, and the content negotiation automatically serves one or the other, whichever the browser is happiest with. You should clearly only use content negotiation when you really don't mind, when you're happy one thing being used in content to the other. Hidabag, I have to say, on one of the Zootia parts of our site, the access control system, where I went in with a browser which accepts RDF, and rather than giving the form, which I wanted to use to change the access control on the file, it gave me the status of the access control on the file in RDF, because I could accept RDF. But that wasn't exactly the... If, It didn't allow me to change it. It wasn't the form, so it wasn't the same thing. And sometimes we've had examples of people who feel, well, you know, I'll use content negotiation, because if you're looking for RDF, you probably want this information. But if you're looking for HTML, you probably want that information. That's not a good idea. If you're sending, if you're got the same information as you can send as data, as pure data or as HTML, make sure the HTML is generated from the data. It's important that those things should be the same. There is a bug in a lot of common operating systems, which rather messes this up. Obviously, an easy way of extending to new MIME types is to put in a hook to allow you to specify a helper application. So, for example, if you find a link to a calendar and you download a calendar, what happens? Well, you serve it up with a calendar MIME type, and the browser saves it in a temporary file, and it launches a calendar program, and it launches on the .ics file. It makes sure it generates the .ics extension so that the file isn't confused, isn't dangerous, doesn't put .exe on it. And what's the problem with this? The problem is that when it fires up the calendar application, it passes the file and doesn't pass the URI. And what the calendar application wants to do is to subscribe to that feed, and it didn't get the URI. So there's a little bug here. When you pass it off to something, so there's an operating system, API, sort of designers, please, in that room, please note and please put the URI in somewhere on the command line when you launch that helper application. Because when you do that, then the people, because in fact what happens with iCal on the Mac, for example, is that they tend to use webcal colon instead of HTTP colon just to get around that bug. Only to get around that bug. They invent a complete new URI scheme. I haven't talked about URI schemes, really. They're a flexibility point, but you shouldn't use them, really. You shouldn't just invent them, because you know we've got to put an awful lot of effort into HTTP. We've heard a huge amount about it today. We're fine-tuning it. We don't want to invent new ones. And inventing new names for it really doesn't help. One of the big questions is TagSoup. I'm not going to go into that in great detail. Maybe maybe there'll be plenty of other times to do it or over questions. I guess my feeling about TagSoup is it's not the end of the world. That is, there are times when I feel that it's okay to end up with two pieces of code. So we ended up with a real XML parser and a TagSoup parser. And the TagSoup parser here is specified, and it's sort of sealed, and it's in a box. I guess I find it frustrating that we haven't managed to make the path towards cleaner code. I feel that the cleaner the code is when people make their files actually XML, then that's easier. I like the extensibility. I think the extensibility is important. So looking back, I do have to wonder whether, in fact, some of the things that pushed people away from XML was the fact it insisted on quotes around the attribute values. I know kids that I know that make websites miss those quotes off because if you leave them off, it saves time and it still works. Now, I wonder whether really was all the effort that people have put into typing those extra quotes. You know, hasn't that been more FTEs than more total effort than the time it would have been taken to make the parser a little bit more complicated? And the spec a bit more complicated. But we will never know these things. We can never know what if. So I'm happy with the HTML working group documenting existing practice. But I think it's really important that we find a way of moving from the messy situation towards cleaner situations incrementally. How can we do that? Well, I think a lot of it counts on what the validation it works. People do check their pages. Actually, they could do it even more if the validator was built into their browser. In fact, we could write validators in JavaScript if we wanted to. Browsers are getting big enough and powerful enough to do things like that. I think that one of the problems with validators at the moment is they tend to just check against a DTD. And the idea of XML was, you know, this X one thing was this extensibility. The idea was that you could put tags in, like, you know, like HTML, put new tags in. When we invent table, we put table in, and if some browser didn't understand table, it would display the data anyway. It just wouldn't look as pretty. That sort of thing does happen with HTML, but doesn't happen whenever we have a validator. Then people aren't discouraged from adding new attributes. And adding new attributes is, in fact, healthy. If you put them in the HTML namespace, obviously, you should talk to the HTML working group. In fact, maybe you should have, well, or you should, no, you don't have to do that at all. You can go to the What Working Group Wiki and just, or somewhere, or the HTML Working Group Wiki, you know, maybe you can just have a little sort of a machine, like an ATM machine in the hallway, in a virtual hallway, where you can go and just select which tag you want and make sure that you've got it. But seriously, you know, for when you shouldn't squat on other people's namespaces. But if you use namespaces, and you can make your own namespace, and then adding a tag doesn't have that problem, you're going to be treading on somebody else's shoes. So it's a very reasonable thing. So how about a validator, which if it finds in there some new attribute with a namespace on it, and it dereferences the namespace and finds something there indicating, yes, the namespace is valid, even something which actually a bit of schema which mentions that attribute value, then that would sound as though the validator, instead of saying the bzzz, that's not a proper file, should say, yep, I noticed you're using this extension. I hadn't heard of it before, but I guess you're using it. And give a little list of the extensions used at the bottom. So I think that what we should do as a community is build these validators which will take anything, compare it with what Henry Thompson was talking about, a page without errors, and then give a list of differences and give a balanced report about how, and we need to assess as a community which things we feel need strong disapprobation and which things are mildly disagree with. Somebody said, I forget who, in the last couple of days, that validators should why don't they validate web architecture? Good point. And to a certain extent, they do. But I think we should have more of that. That you know, of checking the MIME type, commenting on whether it was a good MIME type, reading the page, checking, going to the images within the page, checking that they're served with reasonable MIME types, and so on, and checking all the ways in which things are either maybe traps have been built in, or something which is not, which hasn't been designed in an extensible fashion, so on. So the validators can one way by which we can move people building websites, move people building tools. I mean, also, we could actually stop just giving up on it. I have wondered about giving, when I go to give talks, for example, a classic example, that if you look at the list of, I don't know, top universities in the United States, and you go to their homepages, you find the majority have invalid homepages. Harvard, for example, when I checked, our local neighbor, had a semicolon between two XML attributes in its homepage. Okay, the browser, of course, recovers from this, doesn't mention it, but it's kind of, I think they'd be embarrassed if they had a semicolon misplaced sort of, or grammatical mistake in the Latin over the door or something, you know. Or the sign saying Harvard University outside. So we could pour, you know, somebody from MIT with my MIT hat on, it's my job to pour scorn on Harvard at every point, of course. But we could, as a community, do a bit more of pouring scorn. We could, when we go to give talks at companies, we could first run their, at the beginning of the talk, run their website through the validator and ask to see, you know, for the hands up of who's the webmaster. And if we do that a few times, maybe the word will get around that one should validate at least the homepage. Clearly, validators can also go run over the whole darn site, check it out. But also browsers, you know, the save as, Dan Connolly was talking about the save as phenomenon, and the fact that the web spreads because people look at a page, like it, do view source, cut and paste, stick it into a file. Hey, look, Mom, I've got a web page. Right, change your name for my name, your photo for my photo. Well, I'll use your photo and it's nicer. You know, very, very quick. Instant gratification for getting a new web page, and it all happens from cutting and pasting the source. Well, suppose when you went to the source, there's plenty of space, and you know the code for cleaning up is more a page more or less exists in the browser. All you have to do is to reserialize the DOM is clean if it's got any bugs in it. So when somebody does a cut and paste, you could give them by default the clean up source. So every time somebody does that, then the bugs get filtered out, and we slowly are filtering the web. So we make it difficult for somebody to actually get at the original source without it being strongly annotated. And particularly if they want to do a save as, then we, you know, the default is save clean source as opposed to save buggy source. Maybe that would just, you know, that little change in the design of a browser could just change the sort of the expansion of, sort of the general degradation of the web, the rot of the web, to reverse it and turn it and sort of rejuvenate it and turn it into a clean place again. So browsers could include validators. They could include the HTML tidy functionality effectively. And maybe that would help us fix it. Okay, we've talked about namespaces quite a lot on the panel, so I don't think I should go into that. As I mentioned, namespace is an RDF requirement. It was sort of pushed down to XML and implemented in XML. And people complain because those URIs take up too much space. We've discussed that on the panel, so I won't go into that. Lot of detail. The alternatives to them are sort of having a central registry of terms instead of having using URIs. As I said before, that works for a global set of terms, but it doesn't allow you to do industry-wide terms. It doesn't allow a given industry or a given smaller community to add terms to HTML. It wouldn't have allowed it. Maybe MathML would have had the clout to have their terms all added to the HTML namespace, but smaller things would not have done. And as I said, we have to be aware of all these different communities.
Forgive me for interrupting, but Yes. The captioner cannot keep up with you.
And I've been talking so slowly.
You have... No, no.
Okay.
No. You have not. You have not. What are you going to do, fire me? Thanks, Tim.
So, let's talk about new tags and attributes in HTML. What happens when we put them in? The validator complains. When the validator complains, this causes people who design microformats not to use attributes. So what do they use? They overload classes. Those classes have been used for CSS. They work fine for CSS because the person who writes the HTML page also writes the CSS. That person coordinates that the same class name is in the CSS and the HTML. When microformat designers use classes, it is not a local thing. They have to go to Tantec or to Tantec's wiki and write down in a special holy place the name of the new class. I take it back about possibly having time for questions. So, as I said, XML was supposed to be extensible. So in future, we should feel that when we find a tag with a namespace, one we don't recognize, but where there is a namespace document, that is not a bug. If we find a tag with no namespace, a tag we don't recognize, maybe it's a bug. Maybe it's a misspelling. Maybe it's a misspelling that the web designer really wants to be shown. Maybe it's an extension. No way to know. So let's talk about Canvas versus SVG. There's Canvas people here. Canvas people, put up your hands, please. SVG people, put up your hands, please. People who are both Canvas and SVG, put up your hands, please. Thank you, Håkon. Well, I guess when I see something which is as well developed as SVG, with a lot of test cases and a long history and lots of implementations sitting there with browsers which accept it as a format which can be just pushed in. And I see an alternative being designed. I have to say that I sigh. Next, I'm going to talk about the processing of XML. XML is tree structured. XML is, as a tree structured language, normally you would expect to be processed from the top down. All tree structured things, all programming languages, we process from the top down. So as we go down the tree, we get, every time we go into one element and we look at the children, we get another flexibility point. There's a flexibility point when we first look at the document. If we only know it's XML, we have not been told that it's text, HTML, or we haven't been told that it's XHTML or SVG or RDF. We've just been told from the MIME type it's XML. Then we look at the top element, the document, the root element of the document, and we look at the namespace. And if it's HTML, then we figure that's an HTML document. And if it's RDF, we figure it's an RDF document. And if it's SVG, what is it? Diagram or something? What's the top root name of? I can't even remember. Then we figure it's SVG. But then within that, surely we're working towards an architecture where we can completely mix these things. So we can find HTML within SVG without object tags and things, and SVG within HTML, and MathML within these things. Not only that, but we have an XML encryption namespace. We might find something encrypted. And I like the architecture where effectively we are doing a lazy evaluation top down. So when the browser needs to figure out what's inside a child, it looks at it and, if necessary, decrypts it. And the decryption algorithm is to replace that element with its element itself decrypted. By the way, I won't go into details now, but XSLT also, when it's in the template mode, works in a similar fashion. You have a document which is almost all HTML. Every now and again, inside there is an element, which some little bit piece of it, which is an XSLT expression. So I favor a way of looking at an XML document as defined from the top down. Now, in fact, when we process XML documents, often we just have a pipeline. We have something which will do all the XSLT processing. We have something else which will do all the decryption. And we have these long arguments about which is it philosophically most appropriate to do the decryption before the XSLT or the embedding of the SVG and so on. And XInclude. I missed off this. XInclude is another one. Should I do the XSLT before the include? What happens if I'm including a piece of XSLT and so on? But so I feel the top-down approach actually leads to sanity here, but it may lead to different software architectures. It certainly leads to a follow-your-nose feeling that everybody knows what the XML document means because we're all starting at the top, guys. Okay, so I have said my piece about XML top-down dispatching. The neat thing is now we're doing dispatching between different pieces of software, possibly loaded dynamically, possibly installable, at the element level, not at the document level. Okay, some people, I guess this may be totally obvious, and others probably think it's really, really stupid. That is life in this world. Multiple namespaces in RDF, I mentioned briefly because they do work. All RDF, and now we have more and more linked data out there, all made of RDF, all made of namespaces. It works. RDF is being mashed together all over the place, so it's really performing as designed without the angst of that there is in the HTML community. So, for example, if you go to data about, this is data on the semantic web about me, for example. There's a lot of this data. This comes from DBpedia, which is data from Wikipedia, and that's all the stuff in different languages. There's stuff down here from which has been pulled from the DLBP database of computer science. Bibliography stuff, things that I've written. There's my page about people I know. It all mushes together amazingly. And you can build all kinds of different applications on top of it which use that data. As you follow through this graph, then have I got Hukon on there? You find your way off this one from going from one application into another application. You're pulling in data from all kinds of different sites. And Charles and Kathy Neville has 113 friends. We're into the MyOpera community social network. This is an open social network, so we're browsing across it. It spans many different sites. And there's all kinds of data spanning many different applications. So basically, it works. Multiple sources blend. It's very, very sound. So I'm sorry if other people don't like it, but it's absolutely core to the way RDF works. So we're running out of time. I just wanted to mention a few things that I think are exciting that are happening. There are more things than on this list by a very large number. Linked data, well, that's what we call semantic web data when people actually use HTTP URIs in the web way, so that you can look them up. CDF, I think now, CDF has been around, SVG has been around, but now that Silverlight and AIR are fighting for the proprietary space, then maybe we should actually wave the flag more strongly for what we have here as the basis, a very strong contender for that area from the open standards. One thing that I've got excited about recently is countering spam by using a combination of OpenID, which Phil Hellenbaker mentioned earlier, and Friend of a Friend, the Opal social network, which we were just exploring, looking at some of Charles McCarthy Neville's friends. So, for example, on my blog at MIT, if you are a friend of a friend of anybody in the group, then you can comment on the blog. So we're using the social network to establish trust and establish who people are. Obviously, around W3C, we have a very large number of people. All of you here have registered. We know who you are. We can use you as trusted sources. So we could, for example, say that anybody who is a friend of a friend of anybody who is at the TP, then can change the wiki, comment on the blog, so on. It's got to have a certain amount of trust. That's a practical and exciting way of making the web a better place, I think. Obviously, going mobile, video is first-class citizen. I guess that, I had that on the slide before Kokon used it. I guess it must be just in the air, the phrase first-class citizen. So there are lots of exciting things. Some of them fit together. Here's a picture that I will show you. Here's an example. On the underneath, we find all kinds of ways in which, on the bottom layer, existing data in XML, for example, and in, which has an XML schema, is adapted and converted into virtual RDF. So this is data integration by converting all your existing data from databases and XML into RDF. It's to be seen through Sparkle services and virtual RDF pages. This gives this bus, which is the web bus here, is this blue bus, is the semantic web bus. It's HTTP, it's OWL, it's RDF, and Sparkle with a QL. So that bus is the semantic web bus, and people on that bus can expose data raw. There was a blog went up a few hours ago about saying, just give me the data now, give it to me raw. Don't process it. Don't apologize for it. Don't give me a user interface to it. Give me the data. If you're a government department, if it's data about your products, give me the data raw. So this, if you like, is the raw data bus. And then this is the economy above it, the economy of mashup sites. Okay, these are people like GovTrack, which allows you to put search for people and track their voting and track their voting records in the Senate or in Congress. It's using data from some obscure site, they got hold of the data somehow, and now they have made a nice user interface to it. Web 2.0 mashup of it. Plus, they have made it available in RDF for anybody else to see. So in this list of open data link products, for example, there is govtrack.us. We can find, for example, John McCain. We can pull him up, look at him in a data browser. We can look at the roles that he's had, look at one particular one, find out when it was from, between these dates, and so on. We could actually go and plot that. You can see we could do all kinds of things with this data in mashups. So these mashup sites, there are various other ones. There's one doing a similar thing in the UK called They Work For You. And obviously, there are lots of mashup sites which do this at the moment, but many of them only use data from one source, and they scrape that source. Once they connect into the data bus, they have access to lots of things. So you can then do one site which compares politicians across all the different countries. You can do one site which compares all the towns with how well they're doing mending their potholes and so on. And of course, when you do that, you use the Web 2.0 bus, if you like, HTTP, HTML, SVG, DOM, JavaScript, and so on. Okay, and AJAX, and you present that to the users. So obviously, these two arrows actually connect around the back because they're the same bus. But I think that's an interesting model for the future. It maximizes the reuse. It means that people who have data and an obligation or a need, desire to let people see that data can put it up there and let others do the manipulation of it. So I think one of the architectures that I think we'll see more and more of in the future. Thanks for listening. Keep up the good work. We may have time for a few questions. No. They're all tired. I know it's tiring listening to someone. Well, I'm not sure. Okay.
So, brilliant talk, Tim. You pointed out that the mind type, content type, is one of the important flex extension points on the web. 8 years ago, or maybe it was 7.5 years ago, I believe we made, as part of the web community, we made a slightly incorrect decision in saying that XML on the web would not actually be on the text HTML MIME type, but in a different MIME type. And with 2020 hindsight, though I will point out that at the time I said this was wrong. But that was just my opinion at the time. But today with 2020 hindsight, that decision is actually causing a significant schism on the web between clean content and tag soup. Do you think there is an opportunity to now go back and fix that bug?
That is really complicated. That the questions about what that was. I was going to save that question for somebody just because it's such a nasty one. Which mind types do you think XHTML and HTML should be saved? My feeling at the moment is that, based on the philosophy of having a smooth slope, that we should allow we should encourage people to, when they serve stuff as text/HTML, to serve it up, in fact, so it is valid XML. So they should just stick stuff through Tidy and do it without changing the MIME type. Well, because at the moment, there are web browsers who, for some completely unaccountable reason, after years and years have not actually understood that their application/XHTML, the MIME type for XHTML, the official MIME type for XHTML, isn't recognized. So, meanwhile, we should encourage the browsers to recognize all the MIME types in WCC specs. I think we should have a best practices specification which just shows what your MIME dot types file looks like, what you should put in your MIME.types file to be able to serve the W3C things. And we should pour shame on any ISP which serves out public accounts where they don't allow you to serve W3C recommended formats. I know lots of groups have had this problem. Lots of them have just said, serve it as text plain, because that's the only thing that most of these stupid Apache configurations understand. I think actually that's the major problem. But changing MIME.types is not rocket science. So I think heaping scorn is good on this case. People should do it. And maybe we could make bots which go around and heap scorn automatically, because you can test this sort of thing. So smooth upgrade path. Moving people towards XHTML, I think, is the thing to do, and as I say, having validators which encourage them to go towards completely clean XHTML, but do it gently.
All right. Well, thanks, and we're at the end of the program. You must be exhausted. I've got a few announcements and some thanks to give. Some of you may have been following or may have not have been following, but there's been an ability to follow what the transcribers in Colorado have been doing, and that's a tough job, you can imagine, and I think they did a wonderful job, so I want to give them a round of applause remotely. I'd also like to thank our scribes, the internet people, our AV people, and all the moderators and panelists who put together this wonderful program today. Give them a round of applause. By the way, I didn't mention this at first, but we, of course, had a program committee. You always have a program committee for a program like this. And everyone who's in the program committee, raise your hand. We had a good group. I'll read off the names quickly. Jim Allen, Dan Applequist, Bob Freund, Daniel Glasman, Rotan Hanrahan, Molly Holschlag, Ishak Mahotra, David Orchard, TV Rahman, Shadia Bozara, Susan Lesh, and myself. They did a great job. I hope you found the program interesting and stimulating. Let's give them a round of applause as well. And last but not least, I want to thank all the people who put together, not only today, but the week as a whole. We had a lot of help on the outside and inside from Coralie Mercier, Alex Lavarote, Kaneko Iwasa, Marisol Diaz, and Josh Friel. And they were supporting our lead meeting planner, Susan Westhaver, and Amy Vanderhill did an awful lot of work putting together, again, not only today, but the complicated program that we had in the logistics of getting all the meetings in the right rooms and the AV and all the facilities you have here. Let's give them a big round of applause. A lot of them are in the back right there. Raise your hands. A great job. And thanks once again to our sponsors on the podium here, BEA, Cisco, IBM, and Nokia, because without their help, we couldn't have put on the kind of a quality event that we've had this week. We look forward to, we'll have sponsorship opportunities next year for you also. So please give them a round of applause as well to our sponsors. Great. We'll see you at the reception at 6:45, and the meeting's adjourned.